This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 1 year ago, white South African Mark Baer made a public confession. When he was a college student during the days of apartheid, he was paid by the South African police to spy on students who are anti-apartheid activists. He not only succeeded in infiltrating his campus's activist movement, he became a leader of it. After his public confession, Baer submitted a written confession to South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. His confession caused quite a stir. People who assumed he was a longtime opponent of apartheid were shocked that he once worked against the movement. He had also already become famous for his novel The Smell of Apples, which condemns the way the Afrikaner system indoctrinated young boys. Readers assumed Baer's hands were clean. He's currently living in the States, working toward his doctorate at Notre Dame, and says he plans to return home after his studies are completed. I asked Mark Baer why he decided to confess.
I would say that over the years, particularly since 1990, when I first spoke to the liberation movement about my political past, I have really wanted to speak. At that point, the liberation movement felt that it was not a good time for a white informer or a spy, whatever word we want to use, to speak publicly, in that the very notion of non-racialism, which is exploited by a white traitor in a black struggle, was very problematic in the pre-election period. I think from the moment I heard last year, or towards the end of the previous year, that there was going to be a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, I felt that there was a sanction, a progressive political sanction, on me speaking publicly, or for me to speak publicly. So politically, that was the environment which informed my decision. Psychologically, I have felt guilt, remorse, depression, anxiety, and have known that unless I actually articulate this past publicly and take responsibility for it, leaving behind narcissistic guilt to take this onto the plane of language out of one's own mind, I wouldn't be able to live comfortably with it. So all of those sorts of things, you know, it isn't possible for me to give you one easy answer, mm-hmm. but those sorts of things.
Now, let me back up a minute. You said politically your friends in the liberation movement didn't want you to go public earlier. So that means you had friends in the movement who knew that you had been a spy.
I, at a certain moment, knew that I couldn't comfortably continue being a spy for the South African government. At that moment, I went and spoke with the African National Congress in Lusaka, in Zambia, and said clearly then that I was willing to go public with the information. Then at the behest of the liberation movement, or the representative of the liberation movement with whom I was dealing, I became what was called a double agent and gave the ANC whatever information I had access to. And then continued to be a double agent for 2 years. But beyond the liberation movement and the leaders in the liberation movement, my intimate friends, the people who had been in progressive political organization with me at university, those people did not know. And they only found out about this last year when I started speaking to them.
Boy, I can just barely imagine what it's like psychologically to have to function as a double agent.
Yes, I think one gets into all kinds of knots, and perhaps at this point I should point out that in this country I frequently come across incredibly naive ideas about what constitutes being a spy or being an informer, and there's frequently a very romantic idea of high intrigue, which is belied by one's experience. It is an indefensible thing to spy on people. It is a task which feeds on manipulation. And I think it's very important for people to understand that, that there's nothing romantic or attractive about this, which is called the second oldest profession in history.
How were you first approached by the South African police?
An uncle of mine was a general. I was also from a lower middle class family. I could not pay my university studies to be at university full time. And my uncle, who was a general, thought, I suppose, kind-heartedly that he was doing me a favor by saying to me, why don't you inform? Why don't you spy for us? At that point, I had also just left the South African Defense Force. I had been a Marine officer in the Angolan War. Some of the listeners might want to know that as 18-year-olds, most South African boys were conscripted for 2 years. I went into the army, and I really loved being a soldier. As much of an indictment as that is, I thrived on the life of a soldier. I'd never liked being an informer or a spy. It seemed to me wrong, really, from the outset. However, to backtrack a little, within the context of me having been a Marine officer, having just come out of this war, when the approach was made by my my uncle, I was still very much in a military, patriarchal sort of mindset, in that I respected the rank sitting next to me, asking me this question. And it didn't seem to me to be incongruous with my ideas at the time of slow, ordered political reform in South Africa. It was really only once, probably within 6 to 8 months after I had become a spy, that I started realizing the magnitude of what I was involved in, the seriousness of what I was doing, and who I could conceivably do immense damage to.
What information did the South African police want you to give them?
I was at a conservative white Afrikaans university, and there was a fledgling progressive organization which was affiliated with the National Union of South African Students. And the request was, or the command, whatever I agreed to, was for me to write reports on the sort of discussions which were happening within the organization. This would include, sorry, not within the organization, generally, specifically within meetings of the organization. So I would write reports which would say the following people attended this meeting. Incidentally, these were never secret meetings. They were fairly public meetings in the sense that anyone who was a member of the organization, and it was an open organization, could attend. So the following people attended the meeting. These and these issues were discussed. This and this program of action has been decided on. I suppose that if I had remained a committed spy, to the extent that I ever was one, the expectation would have been for me to befriend specific people with the idea of infiltrating the African National Congress, the ANC, to get into its underground structures with the aim of, you know, undermining the struggle on the ground, particularly the armed struggle, but also to provide the South African police with access to the inner sanctums of the mind of the struggle for justice in South Africa. As I said earlier, I very soon realized the decrepitude of what I was doing, but I was too frightened. I was too much of a coward. I didn't have the moral backbone to quit. And I very soon started editing the sort of information that I was giving through, Within a year of being in the organization, I had also become the leader of the organization. I was the chairperson of the organization. And in a certain sense, could then determine what I wanted the police to know and what I didn't want them to know. So in a certain sense, one really believed in your own invincibility. You know, you were really able to bluff all sides.
My guest is South African novelist Mark Baer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Baer, a South African novelist. Last year, he submitted a written confession to the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, saying that while he was a college student, he was paid by the South African police to spy on the campus anti-apartheid movement. What did you believe politically when you were an informer for the police, yet heading the anti-apartheid student organization?
I believed absolutely within a year of being an informer, I believed absolutely that the struggle for justice in South Africa was a struggle for power, and that that was the correct and only way to transform apartheid as it had been in place for 40-odd years. For me at that point, I made a very selfish and perhaps in retrospect very ill-informed decision, and that was to continue being a spy in the hope that I could manipulate the information that the police had access to. In a certain sense, believing that I had the ability to bluff my way around. I had inquired, I believe, on two occasions, very tentatively, from the police how one quits the police, and was told that, of course, I could leave at any moment that I so choose. But, and this was the proviso, the danger was always there that I would be exposed as a police informer. And I have made the strategic decision then to continue because I felt it was less damaging to the organization to have what I wanted to believe. And again, you know, one bluffs yourself ultimately. I wanted to believe that it was better having me there than having someone else there, and that I had a whole number of other skills to offer the student organization. The student organization was growing considerably under my leadership, you know, and I mean, then all kinds of psychological things come into play together with the political things, and that is the terror of being shamed, the terror of acknowledging the extent to which one was a reactionary, that one was a soldier, that one was a racist, and had made a political paradigm shift. Today it's very easy for me to do that because I've thought about it a lot. I've had so many public platforms within which or on which I could deal with some of this stuff. But, you know, at the time, one didn't want to acknowledge where you were coming from.
What is the most harm that you think you did and the most damaging information that you think you passed on to the South African authorities?
I've now asked a non-governmental organization in South Africa to assist me in getting what might be available of my police files opened so that both myself and my friends and people that I betrayed directly might have access to, so that we can actually look at precisely what I wrote. I think if I did serious harm to people, it would have been in the first 6 to 8 months of being an informer. After that, I do think I manipulated information fairly successfully, to the extent that, for example, when I knew of people working for the ANC underground, I never reported that to the police. And in later years, when I was asked by the police whether I had known about it, would simply deny that I had known about it. You know, so within this very immoral position I choose to place myself, you know, I tried in various ways to to make some moral decisions. But ultimately, and I want to be very clear on this, one doesn't know how the information was used. And whilst no one at Stellenbosch, the university where I was arrested or detained or tortured, it's possible that information that I used, that I gave the police, was used in other ways. For example, to do personal damage to people, to spread rumors about people, etc. You know, and this is part of what one hopes to establish if we can get the files opened, if we perhaps get my handler in the police and the person in the ANC to whom I was accountable to cooperate. The other problem is that there has been no precedent in South Africa for this. So there hasn't been a route which I could follow to say this and this is how one goes about it. It's really been a process of trial and error with me trying to work out in consultation with the people that I betrayed how one can establish at least the most truth possible. Given the complexities of the information and policing network in South Africa.
You first confessed publicly that you'd spied for the South African police at a conference related to the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You gave the keynote at that conference. Then after that, you sent a written inventory of what you had done to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. However, you didn't ask the commission for amnesty. Why didn't you ask for amnesty?
Firstly, having been at a white Afrikaans conservative university, it seems unlikely that I was responsible for gross human rights violations. Note though that I say it seems unlikely. One doesn't know, and one hopes that during the process ahead, we might be able to establish whether indeed I was. I have committed myself in the inventory that I supplied to the Truth Commission to appearing at the Commission if they so wish. And I suppose it would be at that point that I would have to decide whether I would like to apply for amnesty or not. It seems, and from the advice that I've been given by people both in the liberation movement, in the ANC, and by legal friends, that I really don't have to apply for amnesty, that the transgression I am responsible for is probably not of the nature that requires an application for amnesty. But then on the third level, I must say that I have some problems with the notion of applying for amnesty and being granted amnesty for crimes that may have and did in many, many instances in South Africa, in tens of thousands of instances in South Africa, cause immense pain to people and immense harm. I've often thought that were I guilty of causing serious suffering to someone, I would actually prefer to be punished for it and to take responsibility for what I had done legally rather than simply politically. I think there's a certain danger in the process of granting amnesty to perpetrators of serious and gross human rights violations. I think whilst there's a catharsis, an opening up of space in which both victims and perpetrators can tell their stories, one of the problems with the way in which amnesty is being granted at the moment is that there's no requirement for contrition. People don't even have to feel sorry for what they did. I don't know how victims forgive someone who confesses merely for the sake of amnesty. I have reservations about that. I understand the real politics of it. I understand that this is a process aimed at reconciliation. It's a process aimed at creating space in which perhaps more perpetrators will come forward than would if it were simply a legal attempt to get perpetrators to speak. It's also an attempt to give victims a platform to have their voices heard. And I support the process generally. But the question of amnesty is something I haven't really resolved in my own mind, something I feel too ambiguous about to embrace openly.
My guest is South African novelist Mark Baer. Last year, he confessed that while he was a student, he spied on the campus anti-apartheid movement. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Baer, a South African novelist. Last year, he submitted a written confession to the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, saying that while he was a college student, he was paid by the South African police to spy on the campus anti-apartheid movement. Now, there's a piece of the puzzle that I think we've left out. Probably a lot of pieces, but one in particular that I can think of. And that is, and you've discussed this in other settings, that you're gay and you were not out of the closet at the time that you were spying. And the police found out that you were gay, and that was something they could have used against you. How much did that figure into your decision to not tell the police that you were going to stop spying for them?
Yeah, I think the whole question of being gay and having bought into the military system and the male system in South Africa is very central to all of this. I think to the extent that one had led a closeted life as a sexual being, it was easier to live the sort of double life that went with espionage. I, through the people that I was spying on, became increasingly comfortable with my own sexuality. It was through those people that I started envisaging the possibility of living an openly gay life. You know, these were people who were reading Marx, who were reading Hegel and Gramsci and so forth. Philosophers and theorists who exposed the extent to which the world and its morality is a construction, that nothing is inherent, that things are frequently a function of power rather than real. And I think, you know, the paradox of my experience is that If I weren't a spy, I would not have become radicalized. I would not have developed the insights and the political ethics, which I believe I now have. And I most certainly would not have been gay and comfortable and very happy with myself as being out of the closet and unashamedly so.
Did the police at some point let you know that they knew that you were gay and that they were willing to use that against you?
Yes. By 1989, when the political movement at the campus where I was studying had grown considerably, and the police were increasingly seeing me as a force of agitation, of radicalization, rather than as a useful informer to them, I was told that I would have to leave the Stellenbosch University where I was studying. At that point, I made it clear that I couldn't leave because the organization wanted me to stay at Stellenbosch because the organization, the political organization, felt I was doing a rather good job on campus. At that point, the police then said to me that unless I left, it was probable, even very likely, that my history of closeted gay relationships, which I, of course, didn't know they knew about, would be exposed. And at that point, I think I definitively decided to speak to the ANC and also to systematically start coming out of the closet so that this could never be used against me again.
One last question. Your novel, The Smell of Apples, was a critical and popular success in South Africa, and you got a lot of publicity for it, as successful books tend to get. Were you worried when you were getting the publicity that you were going to be discovered? Because this came before you made your confession. Did you worry that somehow something was going to be revealed about you that would lead to information on your having spied, and that right. you wouldn't be able to control the information when it,
right.
when you confess, you control it, you explain it,
right.
you give all the subtleties.
Right. Very much so. I think that is something I want to and have been rather honest about, and that is that, you know, the more success The Smell of Apples achieved, the more I knew that the rationale, the logic for my remaining silent was being neutralized, i.e. that, you know, we didn't want to make a big scandal of the fact that another white person had betrayed a black struggle. And I knew that the more successful the novel was becoming, the bigger this issue was going to be. Whereas if I had spoken in 1990, as I had wanted to, it would have probably been a small scandal and over with. But most certainly, part of my eventual decision to confess was to confess on my own terms, to let the truth come from my mouth, as opposed to from somewhere else. One does know, and this is very important for me to say, that it's possible that all sides will defend their traitors or their spies, their informers, and it would have been possible for me to deny this for the rest of my life, as probably 98% of spies and informers the world over do. I chose not to do that.
Mark Baer is now in the U.S. working toward his doctorate at Notre Dame. He's the author of the novel, The Smell of Apples, about a boy brought up in the Afrikaner system.